Jess, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be on this show with you and co-hosting in this case. We're very fortunate to have Brian Johnson, a bit of a legend in the world of biohacking, doing extraordinary things to help us with science, but using himself personally to solve many of the issues that are going to confront all of us and perhaps find us a path forward to living longer, healthy, or potentially extending longevity in general. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, real pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, as Jess said, the concept of this podcast series is to explore investing in longevity, and I would also extend it to biotech. And I was just wondering, you know, how you think about it, and perhaps you can give the audience a bit of a background on where you came from and how you ended up where we are.
Yeah. The entirety of what I'm doing is contemplating the question that we are on the eve of superintelligence. What do we do? And this is a different question because if you were to pose any question even 20 or 30 years ago, and they could be simple like, how does one live a good life? How does one invest? Should someone pursue health and longevity? You take any question in existence and you would have generated a certain set of answers. This is the first moment in 200,000 years since Homo sapiens came about where we're entirely in a novel situation where, you know, the difference in intelligence between us and other species, insects and or other mammals, were at least a few orders of magnitude more intelligent than them in our ability to do certain things. We're building intelligence that will at least be a few orders of magnitude, if not more, intelligent than we are, a million, maybe a billion times smarter. Now, when that's the case, it's really challenging to know what reality will be like. Because it's to me, it's hard to imagine that reality is going to continue to be the same and we have this intelligence that is that great. And so that's really my omnipresent focus and interest. And every time I'm confronted with anything in life, I'm posing the question through the frame, we're on this, you know, the doorstep of superintelligence, how to think appropriately in this moment.
Given that, would you then invest in current drug development programs, current supplement programs, or would you invest more into AI, machine learning to accelerate that process you just alluded to?
Yeah, I would primarily, I think, try to focus on what I call zeroth principle concepts. Up until this point, humans have been the makers and the stewards of knowledge. So we discover a given thing about mathematics or physics or health and wellness and science, and then we all collectively kind of know a given thing. And some people are more specialized than other people, but we are the stewards of knowledge. And that's called first principle thinking. We learn and then we make decisions based upon this knowledge. The zeroth principle thinking, you don't know. It's an unknown unknown. And so, for example, a discovery of that is Einstein's special theory of relativity, where you can't get there from Newtonian physics. You can't say, what do I know, and walk yourself there. And you can't get to, you know, from Euclid's elements to Cartesian geometry, or you can't come up with germ theory based upon the ideas in the 1870s. And so AI is a zero manufacturer. If you look where AI has been applied, it's able to discover things faster and in more novel ways than humans can. And so it's going to introduce more zeros than at a faster pace than we've had as a society. And so if I'm investing right now, I'm probably betting on the ability for this new form of computational intelligence to do discovery and invention at a much faster speed. And for a society that's going to be ruled by zeros, I'm probably going to invest in organizations that are betting on zeros themselves, not on ones.
I think you have a $100 million fund you set up when you sold your company. And is that the investment philosophy you've had to date? Because I think you did Ginkgo or a different kind of synthetic biology company. So what have you done historically and have you changed that? And then I'll let Jess get his kick at the can here.
Yeah. After I sold Braintree Venmo, I made a few $100 million. I created a $100 million investment fund. And it was a little bit of of an education experience for me where I hadn't had a formal education in science. And I wanted to get into deep tech. And I figured that one interesting way of doing that would be to work in the trenches with entrepreneur scientists who were trying to solve very complicated problems. And so I invested in these companies. One of the first investments I made was Ginkgo Bioworks. And you know, it was interesting. I met up with Jason Kelly at a cafe, and he opened up his laptop and he said, "Here's how we're programming, you know, here's how we're engineering biology." And I said, "How funny, like that looks like the same way I'm engineering payment systems at Braintree Venmo. I can see how they are similar." And it was such an interesting moment where I was like, wait a second, you're telling me you can take the same engineering practices and engineer biological organisms as you can something static or fixed like payments. And then he gave me the pitch that basically, you know, DNA is the largest code base on planet Earth, or it was at that time. And that the way that we were going to be able to break out all kinds of things within that code base was to make it really cheap. And I thought, this makes a lot of sense. You treat biology like we do computer software, and you've got to make it very cheap. So he really wasn't talking about the applications. He was just saying the applications will come when the costs are right. And to me, that made a whole lot of sense. And so I started making investments in companies where I didn't want the burden of having to choose or select or discern whether one idea was right and the other idea was wrong, or whether a certain market was going to move. I wanted to bet on economics, that you know, when something's made cheap, typically it bolsters its own economy. And so, yeah, I took that approach with the deep tech investments I did. And so I did nanotechnology, computational therapeutics, all with a pretty similar set. And this was it was a wonderful experience. It was successful. The companies have gone on to do world-changing things. So I really appreciated that experience.
Would you change that now? And then over to you, Jess. Would you invest in something different now?
Yeah, I would. I would do things differently because the tools in machine and artificial intelligence have changed radically in the 10 years time since I began investing. And most of the companies that I'm familiar with are using AI as their primary discovery tool. Most companies are racing to figure out how to make their problems digital in nature and how to move faster, more economically, and discover quicker, more quickly. And so I'd say, yeah, companies that are AI first in how they're approaching problems, because they're going to, it's so much easier to make progress with a technology stack than it is to deal with a human stack.
Plays into what Jess is going to ask.
Yeah. You know, Brian, that's such an interesting lens to look at it through. I am interested for you, I've heard you talk about this principle before, where it's like, instead of like, I think you were talking to some country leader in the Middle East and they're talking about what they were going to invest in for the next 13 years. And you said, hey, maybe there's another way, instead of like planning a robot where you're saying like, we're here and this is where we want to be in 13 years. Here's how you get there. It's like inventing the robot that can navigate any kind of terrain because you don't know what the next 13 years are going to look like. And I thought that made a ton of sense. And so I guess my question for you is, for investors today who realize like, oh, wow, start looking at the kind of multiples that these technologies would probably demand, you know, and it's like, hey, if there's a, you know, if there ends up being $1 trillion in revenue a year, that's a $20 trillion market, right? But there's also this power law where probably so few of the bets will work out. And then the ones that do work out so much bigger than people would have thought. My question is, where you see similarities to technology investing and where you see differences. But again, putting it through that lens of trying to do things that can adapt no matter the situation.
Yeah. My son just went to college and we spent a reasonable amount of time talking about what he should focus on. And going through that interaction brought to my attention how absurd the world is right now. How could he, in any reasonable way, decide right now what to do and then emerge from school 4 years from now? I mean, in 4 years, we will live in a different reality. And so he ended up choosing math and physics and CS as potentially the languages that are being spoken in this age of mathematics still. And so I mapped this to investors where I think everyone has this same challenge. Most funds look at a life of, you know, let's call it 5 to 10 years. I mean, that is unimaginable to me that you're going to make investments right now and expect payout in a decade. Like, your AGI has arrived by then, or like it's, you know, we're getting closer. So it just is I come back to this every single time. Our reality, we've, as a species, we're up against a wall of fog. We cannot see 3 months out. That has never been the case in our history. And that is very true at this moment. And so I don't know how we as a species make long-term decisions anymore. It's extraordinarily challenging.
So maybe as a follow-up to that, my thought is we can only make current choices with the information we have today. But
yeah.
But we can also make choices that are more or less geared for an uncertain future. So as you think about a principle for, let's say, specifically longevity investors, right? I've been talking to a lot of folks off the podcast. These people have sold companies for, you know, very large numbers. And it's kind of like after they figured out their money, a lot of them are very interested in their health, right?
Yeah.
And they can see like, oh, there's probably a bunch of people like me. Like, this is probably going to make a lot of money. So what's an example of a principle for investing in longevity in a way that anticipates uncertainty?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so if I were betting on trends again, just like with Ginkgo, where if biology is the largest code base on planet Earth, it makes sense to make that code base accessible and low cost. What things will emerge from it? I don't know. But I want to bet on the company doing that. And I think the same might be true with longevity. If you just break it out and say there's the die economy, and there's the don't die economy. So die is fast food and junk food and environmental toxins and, you know, cigarettes and alcohol. And the don't die economy is healthy food and seatbelts and smoke detectors and. That I'm betting personally that the don't die economy is going to grow at a near exponential rate. That either we as a species, when we get our hands on these super intelligent AIs, we're either going to use them to play the games humans have always played, and we're going to become better at war and destruction and killing, or we're going to apply them to a new game of don't die. Because when intelligence reaches a certain point in time, it no longer makes sense to play those games of death, of war and destruction. It makes sense, much more sense to play the game of continued existence. Now, if that's the case, then the exponential curve is in don't die. And that's true for all intelligence. That's true for planet Earth. That's true for us humans. It's true for how we build AI. So if I'm going to bet on big trends, I'm betting on don't die. And specifically, you can track it. Like, what is the rate of a person dying in a given day? How would you slow that down, or how would you reverse that? But that's where I would try to say is a macro bet that would give me the most flexibility given our inability to predict the future.
Yeah, and you have a great lifetime value of customers compared to your fast food customer. So Greg, I know at Juvenescence and other places, you guys have invested in AI machine learning. I would love to hear how you decided which ones to put money into or not. And then I'll hand it off to you to ask Brian the next question.
It was an easier game back then. There weren't very many. So, you know, my whole thesis, Brian and Jess, on investing is find extraordinary people, you know, give them adequate capital and wonderful things can happen. So we thought we found someone extraordinary in Silicon Medicine with Alex and his team, Zev Aronikov. We incubated one based on Charlie Roberts and Jake out of Cambridge. And we thought that we had something there, and they've just received financing led by NVIDIA. So you're seeing that So that AI is definitely playing a huge role. It's going to be interesting. Everybody's fascinated with the drug development side. At Juvenescence, we're finding we're very fascinated about creating machine learning to do the clinical trials. You know, because right now you have to wait a significant amount of time to find out, even if it's an interim analysis, whether the it works. With AI, I may be able to tell after 2 weeks. You know, it may immediately see the discrepancy in the placebo versus the non-placebo. I want to ask a question, though, on something you said, Brian. You said bet on the people who are doing the zeros. And my query with that is now I believe you're absolutely right. And I realize we can't predict the future in 3 years. But at some point, that's going to become a commodity. So how do you differentiate which one when the ability to make the assessment is commoditized? And then do you need to add something else to make it a valuable investment?
I mean, I'm probably a terrible guest for your podcast because
you said don't die. That industry is supportive of our longevity theme.
I mean, I think I could probably string together a lot of words that would be representative of the year 2023, like a general person generally aware of investment principles and the industry. What I would say, what I'm really here to do in this conversation is to try to introduce a new way of thinking that may be novel to people who are listening. And so I'd say what, like with Blueprint, what I've been trying to do is I'm looking at the future and I'm saying, okay, the only pattern I can see that is really clear to me is that we're building intelligence that is moving faster than we can comprehend and is going to far exceed our abilities in every way, shape, or form. And you know, the idea that we're going to make an argument like the machines won't ever, you know, AI will never be able to do blank or blank or blank, like sure, people can make that argument. I'm just going to skip right past it and say any reasonable time frame for any duration, it's just, I just don't believe that's possible. I think they're going to do everything we do and better. And so, and again, my time scales are, it's not whether that's going to happen in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, I don't care. In some duration of time, it seems inevitable to me. So if that's the case, then the what I'm trying to bet, and so my investment fund is like, you know, a couple hundred years. And so what I'm trying to say is when you contemplate that reality, then I'm trying to prepare myself and everyone for that future. So Blueprint is in an effort to show that we built an analog and clunky version of an algorithm that takes better care of me than I can myself. So I'm trying to build, I'm trying to show that my mind was previously the system of intelligence making the decisions on what I eat, when I eat, when I go to bed, all the above. And it was arbitrary. It was based upon my preferences. It was based upon my emotional state. And now I've relegated that to an algorithm. And that algorithm does, in fact, do a better job taking care of me than I can myself. But this observation is computational systems are going to do the things we do today and better. And you know, we largely think about this in terms of navigating us from point A to point B, or in flying an airplane, or in reading images, or in doing drug discovery, or you know, like all the examples we know. We don't think about it in terms of it entering our sacred world of deciding what to eat for dinner and whether to eat that snack or not because your favorite show dropped. That's a domain where it's just like it's not connected. And so, and what I'm trying to say in this roundabout way is investing is something that is done with human intelligence. Now, some hedge funds and others they ingest a whole bunch of data. They run these, you know, very robust models. They do high frequency trading. So they're starting to do this algorithmic approach to do, like they build models that then run that exceed human ability. So we see beginnings of this. I suspect it's going to continue. And so what I'm saying is in investment generally and everything else we humans do, new systems of computational intelligence are going to be emergent. We humans are no longer going to be the primary decision makers on that, or we're going to be part of this larger tapestry. And it's going to enter domains that we consider to be unimaginable, like our own personal well-being and all the above. And so I'd offer that up as a perspective of that maybe one that others haven't thought about and that might be useful for them as they contemplate the future.
So I think you're actually the perfect person to have on the show because we absolutely embrace divergent, or, you know, variant or novel thoughts. And your comment basically should say, if I'm investing, I should invest in a machine learning based algorithm that picks which are the biotech companies or drugs or therapies that are going to work, or the machine learning ones to make the decisions. And that may be what people should do in 2 to 3 years. So would you at this point in time invest in Blueprint, your company, and tell us what Blueprint does other than the overview you just gave us? And would you invest in it?
I absolutely would. I'm all in on this company. And the thought process is that as far as we can tell, we humans will continue to need nutrition. We'll need to put things into our body that take care of our bodily needs. And that's what I'm building. So I kind of went back to like the most basic business of all, which is food. Now that's our starting point. But then of course we can extend beyond that into gene therapy and a bunch of other adjacencies. But Blueprint was not part of a master design for me of what we're doing now. I'm trying to move the Overton window away from death and into a mindset of don't die. Like that's my singular objective for my existence. And as part of that, you know, my process, I did everything on myself, and then people said, make it easy. I want to do it too. And so I just kind of did it as part of the journey. It was not some a result of some careful thought process, just like doing the basic things. But yeah, I mean, I think that where I'm at personally is I really don't care about making money. You know, I've made money. I have enough money. I don't think that wealth is going to be a big deal in the very near future. I think there's going to be other things that are going to be much more powerful. And so I'm primarily spending my energies trying to, like, for example, I've done this Blueprint protocol, but I'm also now trying to sketch out how would I build a 20, 30, 40, 50 million person network don't die state? Like, how do I build a nation state? So if you're serious about this idea of don't die, you need certain things to not die. You need certain nutrition, you need therapies, you need tests, you need medical care, you need health insurance. And there's no government in the world that is enabling a person to not die. They're just responsive, you know, if they are responsive to symptoms and other problems. And so there's no nation state that is actually suitable for don't die. And so could we spin this up? And could we spin this up in 6 months, you know, at a speed that is relevant to how fast technology is progressing? So that's really where my mind's at these days. The one last thing on this, the hypothesis here is sometimes there's weeks of progress in decades, and sometimes there's decades of progress within weeks. I'm betting that AI progress over the coming years is going to create existential crisis for the human race. And it will be things like, what do we do for a job? Who do we trust to run the government? Who do we trust to be president? Who do we trust to, you know, like all these basic questions we as a species have solved. Like we're kind of good in society where we have rules, we've settled on rules, we have processes and structure, and AI is going to call all those things into question one by one. And now if we don't have a confidence in our government or confidence in each other or confidence in our systems, it kind of makes the whole thing fall apart. And that's going to create existential crisis. So when that happens, it's going to create a power vacuum. It's going to open up and we're going to say, what do we do? And that's where I hope to slide don't die in, that the only game you play when you've got the hands on superintelligence is don't die.
I will vote for your machine for president of the United States personally. It certainly seems to be a viable choice. How about you, Jess? What do you think?
Yeah, I like it. You know, Brian, when we met at that event at Johnny Pisana's garage, I think that the concept you were just bringing up was the one that was the most powerful to me. This idea that, you know, formerly our brain was making all these decisions, yet I can repeatedly look at where my impulses to eat, you know, the copious amounts of ice cream that my brain is telling me I need are not in favor of me staying alive for a long time, right? And so this concept of, well, I guess I have a couple questions. One of the questions is about people who misunderstand you. Like, when you talked about this idea of like, oh, if I had a feedback mechanism, say my pancreas needs this more, my heart needs that more, my skin needs this more, like why wouldn't I follow that? And like just like GPS, like people can use a map. It's just pretty much anybody who has access to GPS is using it. It lowers the friction in your life. It's easier. It's better. And like you're more likely to get where you were trying to go, right? Like, so why do you think there's such a misunderstanding when you talk about a super intelligence that can give us all these recommendations? Why do you think people have this negative reaction sometimes thinking like that all of a sudden it will control them? Like we obviously all have the choice whether to use GPS or not at any given moment. We just choose to use it because it works better. Why do people get so emotional about the idea that a machine would know what time to go to bed better than their impulses?
Yeah, there's so many layers to this question, but I'll give you like the top ones. I've been having this conversation at my house for the past 2 or 3 years. So I get a group of 10 to 12 people and I pose the thought experiment. If you had access to an algorithm that could give you the best physical, mental, and spiritual health of your life, would you say yes? Now, on the surface, if you say no, it's insane. Like you've just been offered the best existence of your life. Who's going to say no? But the majority of people say no. And they say no for a variety of reasons. You know, they're worried about what you said, control. Like the algorithm is going to make me do something I don't want to do. But you just heard it's going to give you the best physical, mental, and spiritual health of your life. So you're telling me you want to be miserable to maintain control. Yes. So people will change. They will accept misery, exchange. They don't trust algorithms. They don't trust society. They don't trust institutions. They want to hold on to this feeling of freedom. And then go ahead, Jeff. Yeah.
Wait, except they do. They do with their GPS. They do with their Amazon recommendations or their Netflix recommendations all the time. And like, as I listen to you talk with these people, it seems like they think by having an algorithm or a super intelligence or AI that could tell them, you should probably go to sleep at this time. You'll be happier if you do.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden they've lost all personal agency in life.
Yeah.
To have something like that tell them, this would actually be the time to go to bed now if you want to feel good tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really fun because, so then the next question I ask is, now imagine that the 25th century is observing this conversation. What do they identify as the characteristics of human intelligence in the year 2024? And then people will make thoughtful observations like, well, we really value our perceived free will, our independence. So like they'll step away from themselves and make these measured and calm reactions. But it's so funny when you pose it head on, they have this knee-jerk reaction, which just wants to destroy the thought. But then you create a degree of separation, they can see those attributes in themselves. And so then you walk through the whole bunch of other, like it takes 2.5 hours to get everyone through this emotional journey. It's really rigorous. But this is the thing. This was done when we transitioned from a monarch to democracy. We chose a system of governance and power and information systems that was far superior. And the same is true with our body. Our minds are a monarch. They're wholly outperformed by the body running itself with an algorithm paired with science and data. And so the observation, it's so easy to see. It's so obvious. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. Now, when you pose in the same breath and you say, okay, if a person's overweight, here's this drug. It's called Ozempic. It's going to turn off your hunger sensors, right? Okay. So like they say yes to the algorithm because it does something they care about. And so the funny thing about humans is humans will they'll run their mouth about all their ideas and their feelings and their thoughts and their perspectives and what they know and what they believe. And then they're given an option to do something that allows them to achieve something they care about. None of it matters. They'll ferociously adopt it. And we all do it.
I mean, it does make me, I love when you brought up Semmelweis and the germ theory. And because I'd studied that a good amount and finding out like how vitriolic all the other doctors were at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, no, there's no way us working on cadavers in the morning and delivering babies in the afternoon is killing our patients. No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, it kind of like took a whole generation for them to, for the kind of the doctors and professors in power to die
yeah.
before germ theory became acceptable to the next generation. And like this idea of just how fiercely socially unacceptable yeah. germ theory was for him. I mean, it was very taxing on him personally, right?
Yeah.
And yet, you know, a generation later, when people start living like the theory is true, and then they stay healthy and their kids stay alive and these things, you know, who's not going to adopt it? And it's almost like there's some sort of like familiarity aspect. I mean, like, think about how many times I've been in some city I've never been in my life, and I'm following a GPS, not really knowing where I am. It's just saying left, right, left, right.
Yeah.
Like I could be like absurdly lost in the middle of nowhere. I have no idea in relation to the airport and my destination. I really don't know where I am in the city. I could be heading the completely wrong direction because I can only see a 2-block radius. But I'm so happy giving up that control because it works. Everyone I know uses it and works for them. And it feels safe because of this familiarity aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about human psychology, and like, especially as Gregor and I are thinking about this from an investment standpoint, like helping people start to feel safe, like people felt safe with germ theory, like people feel safe with GPSs, with these type of new technologies. Do you have any thoughts into how to help like our fellow man, our brothers and sisters here on earth, embrace the things that will help them?
Yeah, if you, I mean, there's two examples. One, you look at COVID and you say, right before COVID happened, is there any feasible scenario where the world stops on a dime and restructures itself around a new phenomena? Most of us would have said no, but we had a global change at a staggering rate. Like we assumptions we never would have thought would be true. So humans are extraordinarily responsive. And then on the flip side, we've seen in the history that sometimes it takes entire generations to turn over change. Now, if we just put this in mathematical terms, how much change do we think we might see in the next 10 years? Right? And then you say, okay, now we look at how fast humans can change in the state of COVID, and then like our struggle with change and our ability to like remobilize, and then of the other stubborn, you know, generational change. And so let's put it back with Homo erectus. A million years ago, we're there, and we asked Homo erectus, where's food, where's shelter, where's harm? We listen. They've got tribal knowledge of that relevant data. And then we say, tell us the future of humanity. We're going to laugh. They're going to have nothing to say about computational therapeutics or about taking a pill that just solves, you know, infection or that, you know, all the things we do as a species. So it's possible we're going to experience the equivalent of a million years of evolutionary advance in the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, like some very near and shortened time frame. So that's unimaginable to us that we would go through that much change in as few as 3,000 days. And so if you look at the math on how fast AI is progressing, it's not a ridiculous notion. Now, if someone wants to say, that's just so optimistic, no way. Okay, make it 9,000 days, whatever. It's here and it's now. And so the only thing that matters is that we get the concepts right. The timing is irrelevant. And so this is why investing is hard. It's why going to college is hard. It's why really betting on these big laws. And so this is why I want to say for me individually, I really don't want to be burdened with what to eat or when to go to bed. I want to exist in this future. It's going to be potentially extraordinary. So yes, I'm willing to use a dishwasher and a washing machine and all sorts of technology. I want to use technology that takes care of my health better than I can myself.
Listen, I love getting on a subway and not having to think about driving and knowing it's going to get me where I want to get to. And yeah. I've got all this extra time back. Greg, I would love for you to follow up on, you know, Brian brought up Ozempic. I would love for you to talk for just a second about kind of the financial value of helping prevent diabetes or these other obesity related things, and then let you ask your questions, Brian.
Ozempic was fantastic. I mean, it's the first anti-aging drug on the market. I should say first, but one, it was certainly one that's most pervasive because it lowers your chance of heart disease, neurological disease, metabolic disease. So it's not doing it on a cellular level that Brian and I are seeking. It's doing it for people who are predisposed or have pathology. The other amazing thing about it is we now know what a market would look like for a drug that would truly modify how you age, the ones that Brian has been alluding to, the one that completely prevents infection or allows you to, you know, lose weight, live longer, be happy. And that's $100 to $150 billion a year, for, you know, and depending on your IP, if you're the only one that has that, I mean, that's a trillion-dollar company. So that's what our investor, you know, our audience and listeners need to say, yes, it's not easy to do. We think as we go along, we're going to point out some ways to do it, but it's not easy. The interesting thing with what Brian is trying to do and the difficulty, and this will hopefully stimulate an answer from you as well, Brian, is I don't want you to tell me I can't have the Snickers. I like the Snickers part. So that, you know, there's a discrepancy. And because, you know, as Aldous Huxley said, there's the immortality of youth. You can't tell a 20-year-old not to smoke a cigarette. You know, they think, I wanted to smoke a cigarette. I'm going to smoke a cigarette. And I'm going to live forever. I don't, you know, care. So it's a huge burden. It's one thing to use the GPS because there's no friction. It helps me today and I feel it. Telling somebody to, you know, that they can no longer eat pasta or, you know, that they have to exercise every day and they have to get 9 hours sleep.
Yeah.
And they want to go party, ain't going to work. You know, I mean, it's just, so that's part of the human experience. So on that note, what are the things that our listeners can do, Brian? What are the five most important to live longer, healthy, besides resolving they don't want to die?
Yeah. I mean, so one thought on that is Homo erectus, you know, imagining our world is out of reach for Homo erectus to imagine it. And in this moment, I wonder if we are Homo erectus, where we have no ability whatsoever, actually negative ability, to say anything about the future. And so I agree with you, Greg, if you look back in time, those are the human tendencies we've seen play out over generations, and it's predictable. At the same time, I'm not sure we might find wisdom in acknowledging that nothing may carry over and that we may no longer deal with those same things. And so this is what gets me so excited is when you have the ability to engineer reality at an atomic and molecular level, and when your intelligence is orders of magnitude more capable than you are, this is like, it's a question of like, how big is conscious existence? And like, you know, if you pose that question a few hundred years ago, you could say, well, I have my five senses, I can kind of understand reality. And then you look at the electromagnetic spectrum and you say, well, we actually experience a trillionth of what's actually out there in the spectrum. And then you say there's this entirely microscopic world that is almost unlimited in its existence. We experience this teeny fraction of existence. Could the same thing be true with our consciousness? That our ability to experience pain and love and care and satisfaction and all the things we do is a fraction of consciousness. And that when we have these tools, and so that's what really gets me motivated about the future is most people, if you say don't die, they're like, well, I would get bored. I don't know. I'd have nothing to do. And, you know, like, but I guess like that's just an invitation of anyone listening that it really takes time to sit into this because you have to rewire your entire existence to ingest these ideas that your brain is going to want to shut them down so fast. They're going to want to criticize me and the ideas and think they're not true. Like, it's just a knee-jerk reaction. I've seen it so many times. So like, okay, the five things, very easy. Don't smoke. Get 6 hours a week of exercise. Eat a blueprint and or Mediterranean-like diet. Maintain BMI between 18.5 and 22.5. And moderate to zero alcohol consumption and get good sleep. Like, those are the power laws. We all know them. We learned them when we were kids. We've never done them. So my superpower is in perfecting those things that have the greatest evidence behind them for prediction of life and health span. And I do them with precision. And then I've also done more advanced things, but really the power laws are in everyone's control. You don't need $2 million a year to do this. You don't need a team of 30 doctors to do it. Those are headlines. They're leading you astray. You absolutely can do these things. They're accessible to all of us.
Here, here. Jess. how long do you want to live, and can you adopt them, and what questions do you have?
Well, I know where, it's funny, Brian, I think I emailed you this after we had traded numbers and stuff at the event. When you were talking about this idea of having so many measurements, and I think that's one of my favorite things about your protocol. And, you know, I feel like you're like absurdly misunderstood online. I'd seen stuff about you before the event, but at the event, I really got this message of like, you're willing to be this guinea pig that everyone else can benefit from. And I think my favorite thing is your measurement, that it's not just theory. Like, this isn't like the religion of Brian Johnson. This is the go ahead and look at the data. Like, feel free to tell me I'm wrong, but feel free to tell me I'm wrong with data, not just opinion. And to me, that's just so absurdly powerful because of the ability for the rest of us to be objective about it. And you've given such a gift to us for our ability to be objective about it, and then to see if other people can duplicate the same results by measuring themselves, and that internal confidence for folks to be able to make lifelong decisions is just so radically increased instead of like, believe me because I said so. It's like, believe me because I've got data. Unless you can produce better data, this is going to have the superiority.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to ask the super important question of, let's talk about chocolate, because I am very excited that there is a chocolate choice you endorse. But seriously, because you have data, can you talk about your chocolate and the elements of chocolate?
You're pandering to our audience, aren't you now, Jess?
If the audience is Jess, yes, I am pandering to myself.
Yeah, we just made a cocoa product available. So we initially, with Blueprint, we had to solve our own needs. So we needed extra virgin olive oil of a certain quality to hit those specs. We needed chocolate. So we just started sourcing this stuff from all over the world and doing all the testing ourselves. And then friends and family started asking for it. And then we thought, what the hell? We might as well make this available to others. So yeah, we've got a chocolate product. It has the highest density of polyphenols of any cocoa powder in the world. And yeah, we tested extensively for heavy metals. And it's pure. It's like, I would say it's among the best chocolate in the entire world. And I should say cocoa powder. And we've done that with all of our products. And, you know, we sell it at such low prices, like the olive oil. We don't make any money on that. I'm just trying to make it accessible to the world. Like, I genuinely am trying to get us into this future. Like, you know, for me, like, I guess when I find that framework, like the pale blue dot, so compelling. When you look at planet Earth a few hundred million miles away, and we're this little teeny speck in this large galaxy, it doesn't really matter if the science around Brian Johnson's protocol is right. It matters if the objective is correct. It matters if don't die is correct. And this is, if we can really sober ourselves up, we may be on the cusp of the most extraordinary experience of intelligence in the galaxy, as far as we can tell. Like, this is our moment. And if we can be sober enough to realize that, you know, all of our silly games just kind of fade into the background. And the silly games, they're the ones we're so consumed with, our status and power and wealth and intelligence and standing. Like, these are the games we've been playing our whole life. This is what we work for every minute of every day. We're trying to improve on those metrics. And so, but they really, you know, sometimes they're helpful for this objective, sometimes they're hurtful, but they consume us nonetheless. And this is the opportunity to remap ourselves to a new existence.
I love it. I know we're out of time. I feel like that's a mic drop right there.
We got to have word.
Greg, any last thing you want to say?
We have to ask him, how does somebody buy your chocolate?
Sorry. Yeah.
We have, so the Blueprint Stack, we just launched a family of products. We're competing for the most nutritious in history.
And where
so
can
what we
get
did
them?
Blueprint is we, Blueprint, Brian Johnson. Blueprint, blueprint.brianjohnson.com.
Blueprint.brianjohnson.com.
It's not available to the public yet. Not available to the public yet. We just started a few thousand person self-experimentation studies. We're doing open science. We have a few thousand people doing it. They're measuring blood, body composition, wearables questionnaires, and we'll publish the results. And so, yeah, we're just doing open science like I have been. Everyone's data is going to be out there, and we'll see how it works. We'll see if it works.
Sorry, Jess, I just thought people might be interested. So not available yet.
Yeah,
coming to
of
a
course.
Store soon or a website soon.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, thanks again for doing this.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on, you guys. And again, like I ended up not being a great person for your podcast. I don't think any investor walked away with anything tangible useful.
No, I did. So
yeah, no, I think
I'm excited you were on. I think it was great.
Yeah, when they have that that AI that can solve the riddle of who to invest in and when, it'll be awfully powerful. And as you say, it's probably going to be smarter than you know, the amateurs, us. Thank you as well from my side.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Okay, bye everyone. Go get your olive oil and chocolate.